Act and prior to July 1, 2005. And the testimony that was offered indicated that that 13-month period is consistent with federal statute, and if anything, the creation of this 13-month window adds a tool for management to school districts, and that there really is no particular value to the sunset. And we were curious to know if there was a particular reason we had included a sunset in the draft legislation.
Cindy Hunt, Legislative Council's office. Senator Farrioli, I'm not sure what the rationale for the sunset was exactly. I mean, that's the direction I received. So I'm not sure is my answer.
Who gave the directions?
It came to the Legislative Revenue Office, but I'm not sure. I'm sure that they were following directions from someone else.
Uh-huh.
But I don't know. I mean, because I'm sure they didn't dream it up on their own.
They passed through the office.
I don't know.
All right. And I don't mean to put you on the spot, but
right.
The question of whether or not simply creating the 13-month authority added a new tool, and that the addition of the sunset needlessly complicated it. And the opinion was offered that the 13 months was consistent with the federal statute that would allow other institutions to use the 13-month window.
One possible rationale could be that this whole bill is only directed at school districts and education service districts, so it's very limited, whereas the 13th month federal extension applied to all of these local governments that can use this method.
Mm-hmm.
And so what this would allow is the legislature next regular session to more fully examine this financing method for all governments, not just school districts and ESDs. That may be one reason.
Okay. I'm going to suggest to the members that there really seems to the chair to be nothing fatal about the deletion of sub 2 in section 4. And the only question I have is a logistical one for Ms. Hunt. If the committee in concept does an amendment to eliminate section 2 of sub 4 and decides to move the bill forward with that conceptual amendment, would that be a problem for your office to produce?
Senator Farrioli, no, it wouldn't, but the way I would do the amendment is that I would amend ORS 288-165, which is what this is affecting, which is the statute that deals with obligations, since this would be more of a permanent change to that statute. It would be more appropriate just to go in and amend the statute instead of doing it in this more temporary fashion. But it would accomplish what you're talking about.
Right. As opposed to the notwithstanding.
Yes.
Which, in my opinion, is a much more complicated amendment. You know, the lining out of sub 2 is in my capacity, but what you'd be suggesting is something along the order of ORS 288.165 is hereby amended and then plug in
correct
information. Would that be your suggestion for how this?
Yes, it would.
Could I get a wording from you about how that conceptual amendment might be made?
Could you have the amendment drafted in 15 minutes? I just want to move that down. We only have 3 members, don't we?
There would be a couple of places that it would need to be amended in the bill. Do you want all of the technical places?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. On page 1, line 2, after amending, or after ORS, you would insert 288.165. And then on page 2, line 10, you would delete 4, comma. And then on page 2 as well, line 12 to 18, you would delete that section and insert a section amending ORS 288.165 that would insert the language that you see here on lines 12 to 15 in the appropriate place in that statute, which happens to be subsection 5 right after 4. And then renumber those subsections in that ORS section to reflect that. And then insert a section 4A that says that the amendments to ORS 288.165 by Section 4 first apply to obligations issued on or after the effective date of the Act. And that would take care of it.
Could you restate the insert after 4A?
Yes, it would be Section 4A, which would say that the amendments to ORS 288.165 by Section 4 of this 2003 Third Special Act, Third Sessions Act, first apply to obligations issued on or after the effective date of this 2002 Third Special Session Act. The purpose of the new Section 4A is to make it clear that if school districts right now have obligations that they're in the middle of issuing or in the middle of preparing for, this gives us a date certain and a specific event certain so that we know what the new law applies to.
So, the chair would would accept a motion conceptually amend Senate Bill 1022 as follows: on page 1, line 2, after ORS 288.165.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Crowe.
Just a, I guess a point of information.
Point of information.
We have other suggested amendments to
yes.
the bill. Why don't we just have this one prepared along with the others, and then when we amend the bill with all these amendments, we can just put that in the bill as well.
I've just been advised possibly that, Steve, why don't you share your observations with the rest of the committee?
For the talking point number 3, I was told that that might be accomplished by a budget note in another bill. And item 4, I think that it would want to be applied to a total shortfall, and this only has $200 million, and we don't know what that shortfall is or exactly which bill that number might be in, or what the correct reference bill would be. So
that would not be an amendment to this bill.
So it might be better off to have that in another bill, but
turn to the language.
Try it here.
How about 1 and 2? Do we need amendments to both for those ones?
1 and 2 are in the bill already.
They are in the bill.
But 2 would need, something would have to happen to make 2.
Yeah.
But that's what we're doing by.
Yeah, that's
what the other amendment was.
Right.
Okay.
So I guess the having heard in a sense indicate what the amendments to the bill would be, yes, Senator.
I'll make the motion. Let me take a stab at this and see if I can do this. And Cindy can tell me if I'm right or not.
The council sitting right in front of you.
Exactly.
That's the man.
Lawyers, but I would move that.
Oh, well, we must be in work session first. We're in work session on Senate Bill 1022.
All right. I would move that Cindy do what she said she was going to do. I guess I would just move that we receive an amendment for Senate Bill 1022, that ORS 288.165 to be amended as it appears in Section 4 of this bill, and that she adopt conforming amendments to the rest of the text of the body. Is that sufficient? I mean, they really are conforming amendments.
Yes.
Committee members, I think that Ms. Hunt clearly understands what we're doing. The question I have is if we do this conceptual amendment and take action on the bill today, that we leave a clear record of what the changes are to accomplish so that people following this discussion on the Internet and looking at the public record later will understand what it is that we've done.
To my motion.
Yes.
Clearly, for the record, all we're going to get, and Cindy, please feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, is an amendment to Senate Bill 1022 that will be a new section in this bill that will simply cite ORS 288. 165 with this new language that appears in section four.
Yeah.
And then the rest of the conforming amendments and renumbering of the various sections.
And if I may add to that discussion, Senator, it is in fact that the objective of the amendment is simply to delete the sunset.
That's correct.
That was included in the bill on the 13-month period.
Right.
Do the committee members clearly understand the purpose of the conceptual amendment?
Clear as mud.
Yes, thank you, Senator.
For the record.
And if the committee members are confident that what it is that we are trying to accomplish is to take out that sunset and make this amendment consistent with ORS 288165, then the chair is comfortable to move it forward. We have a motion to amend conceptually. Is there any discussion?
It's fine with me.
Hearing no objections, we'll go ahead and accept that motion as adopted. Colleagues, we are in a work session, and that means we have a conceptually amendment sent by 1022.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Nunes.
I would move that we move Senate Bill 1022 to the floor of the Senate as amended with a due pass recommendation. And I would just add as a footnote that the chair needs to review the amendments and make sure that the amendments are accurate and at least give us a heads up if it's on the floor and it's not, so that, you know, we'll have some lead time, I think.
Actually, the chair will undertake that responsibility, and I guess I would further ask that there be, when the presentation of the bill is made, that, when we do the pony for that bill, we talk about the budget note that would be required for verification and the so that in fact there is assurance that the concern that was mentioned here doesn't get lost.
Right, Mr. Chairman, to that point, you know, we don't have the power as one committee to bind another committee in terms of the adoption of budget notes, et cetera. So one of the things that I wanted to state for the record is that we can clearly, in the pony that's used, state that the intent of the body is to include this in the base for the current methodology we use for budgeting, which is current service level budgeting. And I think if that statement's made on both the House and the Senate floor, that record should be sufficient for our purposes. I mean, budget notes have very little legal effect anyway, but I think we're just trying to have a point in the sand to simply say, this is what we intended. So.
Mr. Chair, and also, I think this is expanding who gets to do budget notes. I didn't know that revenue committees do budget notes.
Well, actually,
we're head ponies.
Senator Crow, the presentation of that bill, I think, is the only place in which I would suggest that it was discussed in committee that other actions could be taken effectively elsewhere to make sure that.
I think you could do it in the pony. Have a statement if you want a statement of intent.
Yeah.
But.
And
I don't know what legal standing is.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
We don't have to support the other bill.
that point about legal standing, the admonition that the Senate Judiciary Committee got from the Supreme Court, the former Chief Justice, and the other members of the court was that to the extent that they look at the legislative record, first place they look is to the speeches given by the carriers of the bills in both the House and the Senate. And if those speeches are substantially the same, then that has a greater bearing on any litigation interpretation of statute. But as you know, they oftentimes don't look to that same intent.
Well, often the carrying speech doesn't speak to the issue of importance.
That's required. We have a motion on the floor.
Mr. Chair, I thought we weren't going to take action on anything here today. Didn't you say that?
Actually, Senator, the bill that we were not scheduled to take any action on this evening was Senate Bill 1021, the first bill.
Okay. I don't think I'm going to vote in favor of this. Haven't yet been convinced that this makes sense to do. I'd rather do other things.
We have a motion on the floor. We will call the roll.
No.
Aye.
Aye.
No.
Aye. Bill passes. Tomorrow we'll be here at 10 o'clock, I think, with the first bill, but I'll call your office to try to make arrangements to meet with you to make sure that we discharge our responsibility to understand this bill, and the amendments do reflect the discussion from the committee. We're closing the work session on Senate Bill 1022, and we are in the public hearing on Senate Bill 1021. And we are going to have Mr. Yates to come up and make a presentation on Senate Bill 1021.
Just looking around for the same thing. So.
He's got another one.
Yeah, how long is your arm?
It's pretty long.
And Mr. Yates, have you ever seen this bill before? Do you know what is contained in this bill?
Or some variation thereof.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Dick Yates with Legislative Revenue. Senate Bill 1021 deals with some changes to public employees' retirement system, in particular with the mortality tables that are used in calculating member benefits when they do, in fact, retire. Section 2 is the ongoing provisions. They take effect January 1 of 2003. And what this says essentially is that the Public Employees Retirement Board shall prepare mortality tables or have the actuary do that laborious task with the most recently available data so that you have an up-to-date mortality table, and that will be done each calendar year, and it will be effective for retiring during the calendar year, effective January 1 of each calendar year. So that's the ongoing process. Section 4 then says, okay, we need a short-term process to deal with people who retire between the effective date of this bill and January 1. And so basically it implements the same process, directs the Public Employees Retirement Board to come up with mortality tables within 60 days of the effective date of this act, and those will apply for people retiring between the effective date of this act and January 1 of 2003. Section 5 then has to deal with review of constitutional issues that may be involved in this legislation, and it directs essentially the review directly to the Oregon Supreme Court, provides for write a petition essentially by individuals and for review, and what it does is not replace existing opportunities for appeal, which would involve an administrative appeal and then a regular process through the courts. But it offers this as an additional way that petitioners can seek relief directly to the Supreme Court.
Mr. Chair.
Senator.
Maybe I shouldn't interrupt. But I was just curious. Isn't administrative review a lot cheaper than an appeal to the Supreme Court? We have average person in here or something along those lines.
Yeah, I think, Senator, that... further down, Section 6 indicates that judicial review is in addition to any other administrative review. So that all the existing administrative remedies would be in place, but this adds another fast track to the Supreme Court.
Can I ask how that works then? If the administrative ones, which I would assume you would go through before you got to the Supreme Court normally, if we're going to expedite the Supreme Court, what does that do to the administrative remedies?
I guess we will call up our expert in these issues.
Mm-hmm. Maybe I should have just waited until this was done.
Chair Ferrioli, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks, Senior Deputy, Legislative Counsel's Office. The purpose of Section 5 is to allow a person who's aggrieved by, if they want to challenge constitutionality on the act, to go straight up to the Supreme Court without stopping, making other stops along the way. The administrative remedies, for instance, through PERS, are steps you normally have to go through before you can move on to the courts. And so they don't really serve as an alternative. If a person is unhappy with the administrative, the decision in the administrative proceedings, they can appeal to the courts. So the point with Section 5 is to say, if someone wants to do a quick challenge, they're going to have to do it within 60 days after the effective date of the act. This gives them a way to get straight to the Supreme Court, not have to go through all those hoops. But then thereafter, anybody, it doesn't prevent anybody else from challenging it, a decision later on. It's just that it's possible nobody uses this provision. We don't want to chop out all possible review of this simply by Section 5. So.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dukes.
Then does that mean that if I felt I was aggrieved and I didn't want to go straight to the Supreme Court, I could start down through the and work my way up to the Court of Appeals and all of that?
Chair Farrelly, Senator Dukes, that's correct. This is a completely alternative method, a very short-lived one. It's only 60 days, and then it goes away.
Do we have some reason to believe that there's a group out there that wants this expedited access to the Supreme Court?
Chair Farrelly, Senator Dukes, I think my instruction preparing the bill was to prepare for a quick decision. I think the concept is similar to what we had with pension taxation when we did it in 1991, where we had a similar provision in the bill. And the idea was is that if it turns out you couldn't do it at some point down the line, it's good for the state to find out as soon as possible, because the obligations stack up and become something you're going to have to pay for at a later date. And that's running interest at 9% usually in the court system. So the whole point was to get a quick decision and avoid 3, 4, 5 years down the line after someone's gone through the normal process of perhaps, administrative process, circuit court, court of appeals, finally Supreme Court, finding out, gee, you couldn't do it, then the solution gets a lot harder. And in fact, the one in 1991 on pension taxation worked, because there was a direct petition, and we got a decision, and we found out we couldn't do it. So it started us moving towards the solution rather than having to wait 3, 4, 5 years to find that out.
I understand, Mr. Chair, the reasoning behind an expedited process, and we've certainly done that in past years. But to leave both processes in place, it occurs to me that somebody just wanted to delay this, could start down at the administrative process, and then challenge that at the Court of Appeals, and while they were at it, ask for an injunction?
Chair Farrelly, Senator Dukes, I think the people who would want to challenge this would have as much interest in getting the correct resolution as well. What happened with pension taxation, for instance, because it took so long, and when you're talking about pensions, is we had a lot of members died before they ever got the remedy that the court eventually ordered. So I think there's a lot of interest probably in the people who would challenge this to get a quick decision as well, if that was what was going to happen.
Then why leave the other one in place?
Senator Dukes, I don't think you want to wipe out any other mechanism. This is only for constitutionality. If this is the only one, for instance, if no one made use of this process within 60 days, there would be no way to ever challenge the constitutionality. And that I'm not sure you want to go there, to tell you the truth.
Senator, I can think of maybe a more likely scenario. This issue is one that I think creates a mandate on the Public Employees Retirement Board in the system. And I think we'd be fooling ourselves to suggest that would be done without an effect on a couple hundred thousand citizens in Oregon, and they will have significant challenges to this concept. So I would assume there'd be a cloud of initial questions that would probably be consolidated as a couple of different questions to move forward to the court. But even pending that review and resolution, there'd be individuals who would retire and upon looking at this formula would feel aggrieved and want to petition personally and go through the administrative remedies that eventually might end up in the court. So I think what Mr. Hendricks is saying, that you wouldn't want to eliminate the opportunity for individuals that would come after the 60-day period and have all the same questions and a legitimate agreed status and going through the administrative process even to the Supreme Court. But if this cloud of folks that come, and I think there will be lots of questions, obviously you wouldn't want to have a long protracted period as they work through the process, you know, get those things in front of the court right away. So I can see the reason that there's two tracks in this bill.
Mr. Chair.
Senator.
Mr. Hendricks, can you give us some insight with respect to what kind of legal issues might arise?
Well, let me ask for your indulgence, Senator. Dick, did you finish your presentation?
No.
Would you like to do that? And then I think we'll ask Mr. Hendricks not to plan on going anywhere for a little while. And it's up to you, Senator. Do you want to continue?
I didn't want him to get out of our sight.
You will not leave the chair. Dick, could you go ahead and finish?
I think in reading the bill, it's a little bit hard to see exactly what the process is involved. Substantive issues are in Section 2, Subsection 2, the comparison of Sub A and Sub B. And as to exactly what's going on, I've tried to just give an example here. And the first thing I want to say is the numbers are not real. All right. What you have in a situation like this is numbers that vary tremendously depending upon who the individual is that's retiring. But I think the illustration here shows the nature of the calculation that needs to be made and the comparison that needs to be made between paragraphs A and B. What I assume in the first box there on the left is that an individual decides to retire on August 31st, 2002, which is the last day that you would be able to retire following the effective date of this act. It allows 60 days, and essentially that's going to take you into August, and September 1 is going to be the first day of the month following the effective date of this act. So that's the last day that you could retire. Now, suppose that a member had a balance of $250,000 and retires under money match. And in this case, assume that the 1978 life expectancy, or what do we call these things, tables, mortality tables. I wanted to say death tables, but I knew that was wrong. The 1978 mortality tables apply, and that for this individual, you look up in the tables and you find out the life expectancy is 18 years. You run through that calculation, and the monthly benefits for this individual would start at $4,056, essentially. Now, those would be subject to the COLA, may increase over time. But that's what the retirement benefits would be for that individual in this situation. Now, how is that likely to change if the individual decided to defer retirement until the end of the year, December 31st, 2002? Well, first of all, member balances are going to increase, and I've increased them at 8% annually. We've got a five-month period there, so the increase is a little less than 4%. So the member balance would go from 250 to 258. And now if you followed current law, you use the same mortality tables, the life expectancy would be 18 years, and the benefits would increase from the $456 to $4,189, essentially, as a result of postponing the retirement date. Now, what this bill would say under Senate Bill 1021 is that the PERS has to go through a calculation which would be based on new mortality tables that they would establish within 60 days of the effective date of this act. And let's say those new mortality tables came up with 20 years for this individual instead of 18, which I think is, you know, it's going to vary tremendously depending on individual ages, but I think that's not a misrepresentative example. In that case, the computed COLA, or excuse me, the computed monthly benefits before the COLA would be $3,696. So essentially, the difference in the calculation is a reduction of about 11%, a little over 11%, from $4,180 down to $3,695. Now, what the bill says is, okay, you've got to look at two things, and you give the individual the benefits which are the larger of one. The benefits as calculated on August 31st, which is the date preceding the implementation of the new mortality tables. So you compare the 456 that they would have gotten had they retired in August with the calculation that you've just done, and you give them the larger of the two. So the individual would receive the 4056 monthly benefits under Senate Bill 1021.
What does it accomplish then?
They're going to retire.
Well, from the standpoint of savings for the state, the benefits are reduced from 4,188 or 4,189, which would be the benefits if you don't pass this bill, down to 4,056. What it also accomplishes for the individual is that they don't fall all the way down to 3,695. In a sense, the accrued benefits and what they would receive had they retired earlier are not reduced. So they don't lose retirement. They just don't gain any additional retirement by having worked that additional 5 months. Now, one sort of very general comment here is if the mortality tables, and again, it's going to vary by the age of the individual, but if the extension is like, say, a 12%, increase in the life expectancy of the individual, then it's going to be a year and a half at 8% growth in your member account before you break even. Once you get beyond that year and a half, then you're going to be getting higher benefits than you would under the frozen level. You know, if a member, you're multiplying essentially a life expectancy, well, it's a complicated formula, but it actually works out pretty simply. So you've got a 10% extension over the period of time that you, or a 12% extension over the period of time that you're going to make benefit payments, but you've got an increase of 12% in the member balance, and they compensate each other so that you break even.
And there you have it. Any questions for Mr. Yates? Senator Deese.
Well, so unless the life expectancy tables don't show you living a whole lot longer than the ones that are there now, you better retire early.
Well, there certainly is an incentive. I'm not clear. You know, there's a lot of other things that enter into that decision, but what you're saying is that for a while, if you postpone the decision to retire while you're earning currently a paycheck, you're basically not going to increase your retirement benefits once you do retire. Now, if you worked a significant number of years, even under frozen mortality tables or even under the new mortality tables, the older you get, the shorter your life expectancy is. So you might benefit anyway as a result of that change.
But somebody who wants to finish out the next rest of the fiscal year or something along those lines might be persuaded that as long as they weren't going to get over $4,056 by working that extra time, they might as well give it up now and get into retirement. I mean, is this another brain drain? Is this another sudden surge of people who in the system who retire?
Yeah, I'm sorry that I really don't feel that at this point I can evaluate that question very seriously or very intelligently. Let me put it this way. If you were to consider retiring in August or delaying it until December, there's a whole lot of things that are attractive or that affect that decision. And now the change is there's going to be less positive.
Okay. Okay, that's fair.
Now, how to go from there? Well, in this case, yeah, you're talking about $130 a month retirement.
For 18 years.
For however long you live.
Well, it's just an actual
might be a year.
If you live longer than 18 years, what happens?
Well, you know, somebody lived less, and so the law of averages works out.
So the payments are guaranteed for life?
Yes. Okay.
But we've been hearing that this does create a kind of window which will allow a lot of people to retire to avoid these deductions and benefits.
Is that right?
Good to be 90.
I've been hearing the same thing, and I guess I'm perhaps more conservative or in some sense less impressed by those arguments. But, you know, obviously there will be additional people who would retire more earlier than they would otherwise retire. Whether that's going to be a crash of people hitting the gates or not, I don't know.
Have we done any scenarios of people who are retiring and what the difference will be and in what they can expect to get if this passes?
I would say, Mr. Chair, I have not, but I think that PERS has been looking at those questions.
I think it would be nice to see what it does mean.
Okay. And we, Senator Troy, we will ask PERS to give their impressions of the bill and even comment as to the need for the bill. Okay. Further questions for counsel?
Mm-hmm. I think we can estimate if there's going to be a wave of early retirements if we know that they're going to be hurt substantially by the bill. And if they are, they're likely to retire early. So that's why we're wanting to have some idea of this, a scenario about what.
I think we do need to, as a committee, explore what the effects of the bill will be. Senator Miss, did you have a question?
Actually, before we get into the legal question, under Section 2, Line 18, Subsection B, it says benefits determined under any mortality table that was in effect on or after the date the member first established membership in the system. Help me understand what that's intended to do. That does this mean that once this bill was adopted, the PERS board will adopt a mortality table January 1 of each year, and that will be different each year, assumedly. But an individual who retired after the effective date of this act could pick any of the mortality tables that existed during the tenure they worked for the state.
Chair Ferrioli, Senator Minnis, it's unlikely that they'll change that often, to tell you the truth. I anticipate that based on prior practice, that mortality rates don't change quite that often. In fact, there's some question whether they need to change them every year, but there could be scenarios where, in fact, they change them every year or two. The purpose with saying any mortality table is to make it clear, and I should tell you that, in part, this language was driven by concerns about Internal Revenue Code requirements relating to implementation of new mortality tables as far as maintaining the PERS tax qualification, which is a very, very big deal because our tax qualification is what allows PERS to invest the many, many billions of dollars without paying any tax on the earnings. So we don't want to mess with that. So all this says is basically that for purposes of doing this calculation, and the important thing here is when the calculation is done, they do one calculation based on the mortality tables then in effect at the time of retirement based on what your situation is at that time, your account balance, except all the other factors that come into play. Then they go back and look at where there have been changes, and the intent is to say, if under one of those tables, under the circumstances immediately before they implemented the table, you would have done better. You would have done better than what you would have get under the new ones. You're going to get at least what you would have gotten at your then current circumstances. So they're going to look at how much your account balance was at that time just before it implements.
So in essence, they're going to freeze in time the benefit that was accrued to that point based on that table than any subsequent one.
Exactly. Exactly. And the important thing, too, from people looking at, gee, do I need to bail, you know, which is a big question on a bill of this type, is there, if you had done a truly, what I would call a truly immediate implementation, the effect, since they have not updated the mortality tables for so many years, the effect might have been that a person who retired the day before the new mortality tables, you know, after a while, it's a little morbid. If you retired immediately before the new mortality tables went into effect, you might have gotten $2,000 a month. With true, flat-out immediate thing, the day after they put it in, if you went into retire, you might have gotten $1,800 or $1,700.
Now, that would be something that might drive people to say, I better get in there and retire before that happens. With this particular mechanism, you don't have that drop-off. You basically say, if you retire the day before they go into effect, you'll get 2,000, and if you retire the day after, you'll get 2,000, but that's all you'll get for a certain period of time, at least until the normal growth from your retirement that puts you up above what that figure would be. So if, for instance, this bill here says that people have 60 days to basically get in and to avoid that implementation, if they're a month late, if they miss it by a month and they come in, well, they're still going to get what they would have gotten, but they won't have gotten anything additional that they normally would have had in the way of the growth. So it takes a little bit of a sting out of a hard deadline thing, by George, because it's flat. You're just not gaining more the stuff you would have gained if the old mortality rates had remained in effect.
Other questions?
Obviously, people will believe they've been damaged by this, and there'll be a lot of lawsuits. How vulnerable are we to those lawsuits?
Senator Ferrioli, Senator Trowe, this has been a serious subject of discussion before the PERS board now for, well, since I know at least last fall, if not last summer. And I haven't been at those meetings, but I've been told basically what's been said to the board by the people who represent, I think primarily, you know, union representatives, et cetera. My indication is that depending on which of the options that the board chose as far as how they're going to do it, they were going to get sued either direction.
Are they likely to win or lose?
The
a good lawyer tells them that.
Yes.
I can only get ours to tell us percentages.
A good lawyer is not always right.
No, no, and all we can do is guess based on what the courts have done before and make certain assumptions about whether the courts will continue to do the same sort of thing. Mm-hmm. The cases we're looking at with respect to this issue, as suggested by Section 5 of the bill, are the cases relating to contract rights, cases such as Hughes v. Oregon, in which the court found a contract right to the exemption from taxation for persons, and also the ballot measure 8 case, which related to contract rights for the 8% guarantee, the 6% pickup, and compensation for sick leave in the full formula method. And those are the cases that are probably going to be the basis for a challenge for this particular proposal, probably from the people who represent current employees, because that's what they had informed the board when they considered this particular rule, if I'm not mistaken. The PERS folks are here and can tell you better on that.
If the courts threw this out, what sort of pickle would we then be in?
Chair Ferrioli, Senator Trowe, the downside on losing the case, as I see it, are obviously the attorney's fees, both for the attorney general and very possibly for the plaintiffs as well. There's the administrative costs of going back and recalculating the pensions, and that may not be an inconsiderable amount given PERS' current situation with their computer system, et cetera, and interest at 9% on the repayment. That's what I see as the downside on the loss at this point.
What about the ability to have new mortality tables to change things in the future?
Senator Trowe, basically what we'll have done is, if the courts go that way, if they took the hard line with respect to the mortality tables, I think basically we'd be in the same place we were with the ballot measure 8 case as well as pension taxation. Courts would say you can change for new hires only. And I should indicate the history of this in PERS was the original rule that in effect locked in the 1978 mortality rates came down in 1993. The board reconsidered that in 1996 when they looked at that rule again, and at that time they implemented what is effectively a second tier for mortality tables, and provided that people hired after January 1st, 1999, I don't know how they arrived at that date, but January 1st, 1999 would actually use a different approach for implementing mortality tables, an approach called the segmented approach. And so for there actually is, under the rules of the board currently, a second tier, and basically they have implemented a change for those people. That does not help, of course, for anybody.
Didn't the board just implement a third tier?
Chair Farioli, Senator Troy, yes, they could.
Would that be better than this?
Senator Troy, we can ask the board, or at least the representatives, first right, tomorrow.
Sure.
Okay. And so we should Senator
Reed? Help me understand this. The issue that's being presented in this subsection B, where you can reach back and pick up the mortality rate then in existence, the language says that you would assume you retired on that date, but the time period between that mortality table and when you actually, well, or the implementation date of this act, we're really reaching back and changing what would exist a benefit today, assuming that the existing mortality rate is to the advantage of someone who retires after the effective date of the act.
Senator Minnis, for most purposes, because they haven't changed the rates up until, you know, shortly here, for at least those people who are already employed, there's only one rate out there at this point.
But let me ask you this question. If we change the language of the bill to say that all existing employees in PERS retained the mortality table that they're currently under up to the point that this bill passed, and then for any time accrued after the implementation of the effective date of this act, then that mortality table scenario would apply. Would that help our exposure?
Chair Farioli, Senator Minnis, that is basically what has been called the segmented approach, which is what is currently being used for people hired after January 1st, 1999. What that approach does is basically say that as mortality rates are changed, that the board will basically, when the person retires, will go back and look and say, okay, for the period of your employment that you were underneath this mortality table before we changed it, we'll do one calculation for that period of employment using those mortality tables. And if there was another one, we'll do another segment based for the period of time when there was a different mortality table, maybe a third, maybe a fourth. So it's segmented in the sense that each piece of your period of employment membership is going to have to be broken down based on which mortality table.
You're saying that's existing?
Well, only for people hired after January 1st, 1999. They implemented it for those people now.
But I guess the question I'm asking is, this bill, as it's currently structured, we're reaching back and changing what an employee might consider to be a benefit, something that they would have had in the form of a paycheck. And we're going back, as opposed to if we drew a line in the sand and said, for any accrual after the effective date of this act, the mortality tables apply and this concept applies, and we freeze in time what currently exists. Yeah. It seems to me that's a safer legal ground, but, you know, I'm a brilliant, genius legal scholar, you know. So
I think we can all agree on that.
I'm right at least 2 out of 10.
Well, that's far. I mean, what I learned from your discussion is what the heck was segmented approach is.
I guess what I'm trying to get to is the issue of exposure and, you know, being a public employee. Most public employees are concerned about somebody coming back and changing something that they had anticipated would be part of their financial future or whatever.
And you should not assume from what I described there about going flat that it didn't mean a difference to the employee, because most employees, especially the younger employees, what it means is basically they'll have a period of employment during which they're not acquiring additional benefits. So if their pension benefit was on a slope like this based on the existing law, the effect of this is to say, okay, for a certain period here, it's going to drop flat and then go back up. Well, by that time, your normal calculation would have put you up here. I mean, that's how come this saves money. It's not like this money comes out of nowhere.
Right.
It comes out of the eventual calculation for the thing. It's not like it's a painless thing. My only point was that for people close to retirement, the failure to
you know, get in there within a month or two if this bill should become law, may not be quite as dramatic as it first looked. So you may not get, you know, you're really, the real impact, I think, is probably on people who are in mid-career, et cetera, because of that plateauing effect and the fact that, that it kind of drops it down to that lower level and holds it there for the rest of your career. So it does have that impact, and that's where the savings come from that show up in the employer contributions.
I understand, but then maybe you can't say this. Don't you think we're more likely to be sued under the existing structure of this bill?
Under the structure of the bill? As far as likely to be sued, I think you need to... I do know what I've been heard in the hall and talking with folks, but I think it'd be better to ask the folks involved, because I know that some of those folks have put out, staked out positions. I know, well, I don't think I'd say anything more than that.
Mr. Vance, have you finished your line, Senator, of question?
Yes.
We have, in fact, a fiscal analysis for this stuff, and it's in the process of being copied for the members. So when that back will have Mr. Yates discuss the fiscal impact of the bill. Does the committee have any further questions for Mr. Hendricks? No. You need to know more about this bill, I think.
We do, and I was curious as to whether or not Mr. Chamoff had any comments for the record.
We'll ask Mr. Chamoff. No, they had, for those not listening on the internet, he had not as in, no. We have some folks that have signed up to offer some testimony, but I think we have the fiscal analysis. So, Mr. Yates,
I think if you want someone to explain it, it should be someone from the fiscal.
Haven't
even read.
Do we have that person?
Well, if you mention it, they might show up.
I'll let the record show a stampede of people to get the fiscal analysis. And do we have someone from which they can present the analysis?
I don't see.
I was driving up here, not sure what it was going to be down there.
She didn't give you a
copy. I didn't think I got one. No.
Why don't you people walk up and sit? I love it. This informal special session is not here. And while the committee gives a quick first read to the document prepared by the legislative fiscal officer, staff is frantically trying to locate the author of this document.
Oh.
Ask those questions will inevitably arise after we read this.
There we go.
And Mr. Chariot notes that $1.5 billion savings to unfunded liability if acceleration of retirements results. So we're counting on people retiring soon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair.
You have interesting, day, Dallas, so far?
Yes.
We have not actually had even a chance to read through fully the fiscal analysis for the proposed legislation, Senate Bill 1021, but perhaps if you could walk us through the fiscal analysis, that would give us a better handle on what's happening.
Certainly, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Dallas Wyand of the Legislative Fiscal Office. The fiscal analysis, I've given you the fiscal impact, talks about the effect on expenditures to implement this, as well as the potential savings to governmental agencies. So I will, you already know the what's in the bill, so let me just go straight to the fiscal, if that's okay, with the impact on the operations of, first of all, PERS and to a lesser extent, the court system. The public employees retirement system to implement this would basically have two sets of costs to incur, and one would be to process those retirements that would be filed within the 60-day window, I call it, in the analysis, whether that would cause a rush to the exits, and if so, what would it take to accommodate that, and then some longer-term costs potentially of implementing these changes within the existing information systems and operations. We have received from PERS estimates ranging from $900,000 to $1.7 million to implement processing of these. The difference between the two, and this is based on processing 7,000 retirements. Currently, PERS is staffed to process approximately 4,000 retirements a year. They're currently looking at a possible number of 5,600 to 5,800 retiring this year, a little higher group, a larger number than in the past. And so they've set some procedures in place to shift resources and the like internally at the expense of other operations to accommodate that. However, if it were to reach the 7,000 number, it would put a considerable strain on their existing capabilities, and they would have to fill in with we estimate temporaries. You wouldn't have time really to hire limited duration personnel with that short window. I would estimate temporary people over time, and also then the recipients of benefits would probably be receiving what I would call an estimated retirement benefit. The law requires that they receive a check within 62 days of retirement. PERS currently targets 45 days, so it tries to beat the deadline. But with a group that large, you would probably have to process estimated benefits, get the checks out the door within the prescribed timeline, and then afterwards rework the benefit computations to come up with a more accurate and permanent retirement benefit, and then make those adjustments and then prepare the benefits or process them on out into the future. So that's what the reason for the estimated cost of between $900,000 and $1.7 million. Another one also has to do with comparing of the benefits without getting into all the different ramifications or possibilities or things that they have to look at. There will be a sizable amount of paperwork and manual computations. With the existing system, it currently provides about 60% of the computational wherewithal needed to process retirements. So as you have more of them, you're going to require more manual computations. That's not to say that it can't be done. So that's the out-of-pocket cost per. It will put a strain on it administratively. You know, if there's that rush to the exits, you'd probably expect to see the lights on a tiger 24 hours a day for a couple of 3 months. On the other side, there's the cost savings, which I'll get into later. There may be a little bit of cost with the court system, where this has direct access to the Supreme Court, which is not set up to handle cases such as this. You know, the Supreme Court always handles appeals, and it's on usually constitutional natures, and you don't have a lot of witnesses coming in and aggrieved parties. It's attorneys representing people. So they have estimated a cost here and a number of cases. It's in the narrative. It would range up to maybe they've estimated $163,000, depending on the number of cases and the like. They would have to hire some additional staffing to help process them. That money, of course, would come out of the general fund. The PERS costs would be other funded, and they would have to come to us and seek other fund expenditure limitation. And they could do so from the emergency board, and it wouldn't necessarily need another appropriation in the bill. The effect on others is there's significant savings, potential savings to employers, and that, of course, is what is driving this. The PERS actuary has estimated immediate implementation without a rush to the exits would save the fund approximately $1.5 million 1.5 billion, I'm sorry, it was unfunded liability. And that equates to about 2.1% in employer rates. If there is a rush to the exits, then of course you don't have the savings for all of the people, and they estimate that the actuary estimates based on what is seen as a trend in retirements and some speed ups over time because of certain things, that savings to the system would be about 1.4 billion reduction in the unfunded liability, and that would translates into about a 2% reduction in employer rates. What I've provided you here with is an estimate then of the what would be, I would call, the general fund impact of that for the next biennium, 03-05. The reason I used 03-05 is although it has a January 1 date, PERS normally adjusts employer rates about every biennium, and it takes effect on July 1st of the odd number of years to coincide with the state's budget cycle. So my assumptions here are that PERS would not adjust employer contribution rates until the 03-05 biennium. The effect, though, based on some numbers that we have been provided out of the state's payroll system in higher ed, is that for a biennium, just in general fund for state payroll, that 2% savings on the employer contribution rates would equate to $28 million or more. For state schools and school districts, which we subsidize greatly, so there would be their savings could be offset then by the endowment fund or whatever support we provide schools, would be about $90 million to the system. But overall, the estimate based on numbers we've seen in PERS financials as to contributions and the like, more than $6 billion is covered. So that in a year in covered wages. So that's about $120 million a year, or $240 million or more a biennium in savings to employers through contribution rate, the reduction in contribution rates. Understand, of course, that there's a scheduled increase coming up because of losses to the system, so that you can't go and bank this because there's a corresponding or larger, if you will, potential increase out there because of losses occurred in the marketplace in the past couple of years. But just looking at this, this will, as the bill is written, save employers about 2% of covered payroll and contributions to the system.
Okay. So just in summary, the reduction of 2% is significant. Biennial savings to employers. It's a potentially $1.5 billion drop in unfunded liability. And that translates into about $120 million a year in savings, 90 of which accrues to schools and about 28 of which accrues to state agencies.
The $120 million is per year, so about $250 million a biennium, of which the 90 and 28 would apply.
And that is precisely why we're looking at this actuarial adjustment and the segmented calculation system. Mm-hmm. Questions?
Yes.
Senator Fish?
Thank you. Dallas, you said that that's per year. It looks like you've got it biennium.
The per year is in the narrative, Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher. The per year is in the narrative of about $120 million. PERS presents financial statements annually, and the last I looked at, it looks like about $6 billion per year in covered payroll, which equates to on 2% of $120 million a year, so $240 million, $250 million a biennium.
If I may, Senator Fisher, under the effects on others there, you've got state agencies and school districts. That's not all of the group affected. That's why those don't add. You've got local governments, and you've also got the highway fund and other state funds.
It was close enough that it confused me.
Yes.
Do you have an estimate for local government, how much? You gave us for the state, and you gave us for school districts, but you didn't give local government.
I can get that for you, Mr. Chair, Senator Troll. I'd hate to pull it off the top of my head.
Senator Troll, on our...
Some other place.
Senator Troll, on our witness list, we have folks from Associated Oregon Counties and League of Oregon Cities, and a Special Districts Association. So we will have them as a panel next and ask that very question.
Okay.
Any other questions, Mr. Warren? If not, I appreciate the presentation, and thank you for spending your evening with us. There are some folks who have, in fact, signed up to present their perspective of this legislation. We have Maria Keltner, David Barenberg, and Hasina Squires representing Associated Oregon County, the League of Oregon Cities, and Special Districts Association. And we have Anthony Gaeta from Wayne County. So if we could bring them up just as a panel of three or four, we'll just do this in rotation and notice that you are neutral on the bill but may have some explanations about fiscal impact. Please begin. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Chair Ferrioli and members of the committee. My name is Maria Keltner, and I represent the League of Oregon Cities and Association of Oregon Counties in this issue. As you know, the cities and counties are struggling to pay the cost of bills for PERS, and we really appreciate your considering the mortality tables as a way to deal with the cost of PERS and implementing updated current mortality tables. We want to look at Senate Bill 1021 more thoroughly. That's why we marked neutral. Look at the implications and then come back in terms of a position. And we also want to discuss the issue and the bill with the other stakeholders to see if there's a place where we can reach common ground. So we're really appreciating you looking into this.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Dave Barenberg from the League of Oregon Cities. We really appreciate the committee's interest in this important issue and look forward to sitting down with the other parties, and I think we appreciate the renewed or the heightened interest in this issue. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Anthony Beaton. I represent Lane County. Lane County has been tracking the various cost factors that are pushing up the cost of PERS benefits for our employees in front of the board for a number of years and other venues, and we're very interested in seeing implementation of actuarial equivalency factors that provide some relief for that upward pressure on rates. The impact of that upward pressure on rates, of course, diminishes our ability to provide services and programs that fit the needs of our community and continue to take money off the table for to pay for the cost of labor. So we're interested in seeing something done right away, and we're eager to participate in the discussion with the other stakeholders.
Good evening, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Hasina Squires on behalf of the Special Districts Association. Our membership consists of 800 special districts throughout the state of Oregon. Approximately about 250 of those participate in the PERS program. We're about half of the local government, non-school cities, county special districts. We're about half of the local government employers. What you probably haven't heard is that the PERS board directed staff to form an ad hoc committee that consisted of labor and management representatives to go through and look at this very controversial, difficult issue, and that has taken place in the interim. One issue that hasn't been brought up, the school boards are not here this evening, but it was an issue that, one issue that we could all agree upon, both labor and management, was if an implementation date was going to be set, that date not be set January 1. Out of deference to school years and how they operate. Having an implementation date of July 1 would be much more preferable to the school districts, and not representing the school districts here, but I do remember that issue coming up and out of the ad hoc committee and it being forwarded to the PERS staff, who I think, you'll have to clarify that with them tomorrow, I think rejected that notion. So it was the one thing that we all could agree upon, and if you were to move forward, I think we would probably still, okay, apparently they withdrew their objection to that, but there is at least one thing in this whole mess that we can all agree upon, and it's a July 1 implementation date, mainly to do with the school district issue. The fiscal impact indicates about a 2% employer rate reduction. As most of you are probably aware, the most recent information we have is that there will be approximately system-wide average increase of 4% increase to employer rates coming in the not-too-distant future. I guess from our association's perspective, we would like to express our concern for the creation of any additional or any litigation that may occur out of this. We are tired of fighting in court, and if we can reach some sort of compromise or resolution with the other stakeholders in this issue, we would like to do that.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Fisher.
Thank you. Your January 1 date that you're referring to is the January 103 date in all of the sections here?
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, yes. If the implementation date, if we could all agree upon a solution, if the implementation date could be could accommodate the school district year or fiscal year beginning on or ending on July 1, that I and you'll have to ask the other stakeholders, but that would be preferable.
Follow up,
Senator Fisher.
Section 2, it lists effective on establishing these effective every January 1. That would also be July 1.
Senator Fisher, yes.
Further questions or questions for the panel? Ms. Squires, you mentioned that an ad hoc committee was formed, and at whose request and who were the participants in the ad hoc committee? And what was the sort of presentation of their recommendations to whom? If you need a little background on the ad hoc committee.
Senator Farioli, to the best of my recollection, the issue of immortality, I can't really remember how the whole issue of mortality tables arose. Perhaps Maria can, but when the issue came up, there was significant consternation among all of the parties, and I think the board then directed the staff to get all the stakeholders together so we could all get a handle on what are the existing mortality tables doing, why haven't they been updated, a look at the history of that issue. I think the PERS staff would be better suited to answer
that. And to your recollection, that was the PERS board that made the recommendation for the ad hoc committee? Or was it another entity that brought
it? It was an advisory committee from PERS.
Okay.
Set up by the PERS board and the PERS staff.
Okay. And we will ask the folks from PERS about that. That obviously appears to be an appropriate question to direct to them. I was just curious to know if the recommendations had been made and whether a presentation had been made and whether this bill reflects any of those recommendations.
Senator Farioli, there were extensive meetings held between the labor and management stakeholders and the PERS staff, and there were minutes taken of those meetings, and there were also recommendations that were forwarded to the board. And at that point, all of those issues from the ad hoc committee were then forwarded to the board, who then had their own subcommittee, to the best of my recollection, off of the PERS board to bring a recommendation then to the full PERS board.
That's interesting.
Does Senate Bill 1021 reflect the recommendations of the subcommittee or not? And if not, where did the bill come from, this one?
Senator Trowe, there was disagreement between the labor and management representatives about when the appropriate, whether or not there should be a multi-segment approach or a five-year wear away. And the PERS staff would be, if Delaney's on the back, would be much better suited to talk about the different approaches that were discussed, the costs to implement those, and where everybody.
Gathering from what you all have testified, though, is that there needs to be further compromise. This bill is not the vehicle by itself.
Senator Tro, speaking for the Special Districts Association, we are interested in reaching some sort of compromise that minimizes the amount of litigation that will occur over this issue, yes.
And Senator Tro, for the League of Oregon Cities and Association of Oregon Counties, they haven't reached a conclusion in terms of the bill.
This one?
Yeah, they would like some further time to look at it.
There's no recommendation.
Please, tomorrow at 10.
This session may not last forever.
Yeah, I'll do that. Senator Tro, in point of fact, we'll have the folks from Labor who make an offering today, and then tomorrow we're going to request that the first folks come back and make an offering about some impressions. But it's clear that the group that's here before us constitutes the employer of a lot of folks that are in the PERS system. Do they know where you are, by the way, this evening?
Being broadcast over the net.
Good. And I think it's fair to remind everybody that every legislator in the building is covered by the PERS program as well.
No, we're not.
No.
Oh, no?
Opted out.
Oh, one opted out. Okay.
I understand Wayne Shutter was not
as well. At any rate, clearly the employers are looking at the unfunded liability, and the only place to pass off that unfunded liability is to taxpayers. So there is a problem, and as Senator Tro indicated, you're here to indicate that you're very willing to continue working with proponents of this bill and opponents of this bill to come to some closure on what the bill does. And we'll just leave it at that. I'd like to bring forward folks representing Labor, Mr. DeLatchment, Pat West, and others, if they so desire. And we heard from the previous panel that it doesn't seem that anybody's wedded to any particular principle in the bill, except that there is some relief necessary. So. What can we learn, Mr. DeLatchment?
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Brian DeLatchment. I'm representing my multiple clients that are public sector employees, and Pat, obviously.
Pat West with the Oregon State Firefighters, and we're both here to speak for the Public Employees Coalition.
One additional disclaimer is there was discussion as to who the two of us that would come forward are, and whether or not there would be potentially, if some of the other members at a later date had something to add, whether they'd had that opportunity.
They will do.
And I want to just put that on the record.
Yeah. And so today you're representing some 200,000 Oregon employers.
And they're listening out there.
Yes.
Let me start actually by answering one of Senator Tro's last questions, which was, does Senate Bill 1021 reflect any of the discussions or any of the options that either the PERS subcommittee on this particular issue, the full board, or the working group or task force or whatever it was called on the actuarial tables had discussed? And the answer is no. And I'll let Pat talk a little bit later about that, but let me start by laying down some goals that all of us who approached this issue discussed, and I think pretty much bought into. The goals were to get the PERS system to the new tables, and I would add a comment of saying sooner rather than later is preferable, including from the employee's side, because it isn't anybody's benefit to have drawn out litigation that doesn't get us to where we need to and puts additional strain on the system or on the employers.
Mm-hmm.
Savings to the system, and there's obviously a discussion of what's the right amount of savings. The different options have different amounts of savings, and some are more immediate and some are more over the entire period of employees that you have in the system right now. Does whatever solution you have to this cause a mass exodus of employees that causes you other problems, for example, school districts, police forces, fire operations, so forth? Everyone at the table had agreed that we were going to try and come to solutions that didn't cause that to occur. Meets the litigation proof test as much as possible, I would add. There had been a number of solutions as I indicated, that were discussed, I think there was 8 or 10 that we started with, and again, this was not one of them. And it was narrowed down to a couple of potential options for a number of reasons, but among them were whether they would stand up to litigation. Does it jeopardize the system with IRS status? Obviously, very important to the system, to the state, to the employees. And you heard a little bit about that from your legal counsel. And the additional question or statement that was done by the representative from special districts, which was the concern about meshing whatever implementation dates with the real dates out there that matter to particular people, and school districts are one. And so when you put a date that's in the middle of a school year and people are making decisions about retirement December 31st and walking out the door and saying goodbye, that causes school districts some major problems. Mm-hmm. And so all of us pretty much agreed on that. With that, I'll let Pat talk about the system, how we got to here, the discussions with that group, and the two that were still on the table with both the board and with all the parties.
Mr. West. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, again, my name is Pat West with the firefighters. And I was involved in the process, the group that was put together to see whether we could come up with some mutual ground. And the reality is we didn't. Basically, we ended up with the employee group advocating what we call the multi-segmented approach. There was another recommendation, which was called the five-year wear-away. The primary difference came down to two different things. One being one thing that hasn't been discussed much other in terms of dollars, and that is the fairness to the retirees, the members of the system. What they had been promised as far as retirement. And the multi-segment approach is the one that, in effect, takes into account their account balances at the time that you implement a new table. So what it does is say that the monies that you have in the system, the years that you have in the system, you are held harmless, and you will get the benefit that was told to you that you will get for those years. For future years, as a new table is put into effect, it will, in effect, creates a new segment, multi-segmented approach. Very similar to what's already in effect for the rest of the employees that went into effect in 1999. That is the recommendation that, in fact, the subcommittee for the PERS board, they had a subcommittee that reviewed this, made a recommendation to the full board on the multi-segmented approach, but there was, unbeknownst to us, they would have closed sessions dealing with the legalities, executive sessions. So we don't know exactly what was told to them in these sessions, but everything has got kind of pushed off, meaning that they are still they haven't done a vote on the full PERS board. Okay, so that's kind of the history of what has happened. What I can tell you is that the Public Employees Coalition, as a group, is and has said that we will be in favor of the multi-segmented approach, and at least from our viewpoint, ends the problems of potential litigation. I don't have the hard numbers. I know that it's in the $400 million savings as opposed to the numbers that you have on this bill. But it's also treats the employees fairly. It is, in our opinion, legal, and will withstand the litigation test.
I guess what I need to do in my mind is get a clear delineation between the segmented approach that's in the bill and the approach that you're describing, which is different. It sounds like it's different. And
considerably.
And for the purposes of discussion, can we characterize them in some way other than using the word segmented to describe both of them? I think that's going to cause confusion.
The years that you have, if they implement January 1, because that's what the bill says, January 1, 2003, then the years that a person has worked up till January 1, 2003, they would have the old actuarial table used on those years and the monies that they've contributed to PERS. It would be held harmless. Future years would be based on the new mortality table. And if multi-segmented, meaning that if in 2 years or 4 years or 6 years they come up with new, or 1 year, they come up with new mortality numbers, it would then adjust again and adjust again.
Mr. Chair, I think the confusion, I wouldn't call Senate Bill 1021 a segmented approach. I think we have been using the multi-segmented approach to describe the insulation of and potential to be working off of multiple tables at once for an individual employee. Yes. And so what Pat has described to you is, for example, a police officer who has worked 15 years and the line is drawn in the sand, and then they work 10 or 15 years more than that, then it's really a melding of those two tables that gives them the final calculation. And it potentially could be a melding of multiple, more than two, could be three. This approach is not, I guess, what I would call a segmented or multi-segmented approach. It draws a line in the sand and freezes a benefit at a certain level until you work your way back up to that level or higher with additional years.
All right, so the 1021 approach is the one that features freezing the benefit and then working back up as the earnings accrue. Okay, and let's just call that the 1021.
Yeah, 1021.
The draft bill.
Okay,
and the approach that you are proposing would be a better alternative.
If I may just make a couple comments on that.
Please.
From our perspective, there's advantages to it.
Yeah.
One is that it seems to meet the litigation test the best of all the options that we've seen, including the 8 or 9 that were explored by the working group and the subcommittee at this point. So we've been reviewing this for a long time. From our perspective, and I think from some other perspectives, it seems to meet the litigation test the best. And let me remind you that there is no savings if something's not implemented because it's in litigation for 3 to 5 years. So you can have a chart that says it's going to save $240 million on 1021, but if it's in litigation for 3 to 5 years, it doesn't do anybody any good. And we'd like to avoid that. It doesn't cause a mass exodus. And let me really emphasize that. In my first reaction to 1021 is I believe it would cause a mass exodus of employees on the date before the implementation. That causes massive confusion for local governments, for school districts, and so forth. And I was thinking in terms of school districts when I first looked at it and said, these people are going to work up until that date, and then they're out of here mid-school year. And the multi-segmented approach doesn't do that. It says the benefits that you've accrued to that point are there. And then you just accrue them at a different rate from point X forward. There's no incentive for an employee to leave in mid-school year, or before they normally would. So we think it's got a major advantage from that perspective.
Okay, so the two approaches that I could refer to are the multi-segmented approach and the 1021 approach.
Yeah. And the third one, and I don't want to be remiss, because you probably will hear about it, is what's called the wear-away plan. And that's the other plan that is still in discussion that, although has not been recommended by the PERS subcommittee, was one of the final two that full group came down to.
And how do we derive the name wear away? What feature does that describe?
Yeah, probably better described tomorrow by PERS staff as the wear away. But the wear away plan, as I understand it, is once you establish the implementation date for 5 consecutive years, you would implement the new table 20%. So
it's an incremental implementation.
Yeah, of 20% of the new table.
Okay. So it doesn't surprise me that there are more than two approaches to this. I can't imagine that there won't be more. But what I've heard you suggest is that new tables are necessary. And so that's acknowledged by labor that that's an issue. That savings to the system are necessary. And I imagine that was a pretty tough acknowledgement to make, because savings can only come from the employer contribution or the employee contribution.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think there's a recognition by all the employees groups that there is some need for some change for updating the actuarial table, and we do recognize where that impact is.
Right.
You know, either it impacts the employers or it impacts the employees. And we do recognize that and acknowledge it and still believe that the system, the actuarial new tables need to be implemented.
Yeah.
So it's a matter of how do we get there.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, for this issue, for me, that is the definition of good faith, is that people are recognizing the same set of problems. And I would assume there are going to be a lot of different approaches to trying to solve those. Senator Fisher, did you have a question?
Well, I defer to Senator Dukes. I believe I had one for you.
Senator Dukes, please.
I think I got at least two of those. But it's 20 to 7, and we meet tomorrow morning. Can somebody, and I don't know if it's better if per staff do it, I'd be happy if you do, I don't care who, us visual learners, somebody lay these things out on individual, you know, sheets or something and label them so that it still makes sense to us.
We'll undertake to have staff do something.
Okay. Yeah, staff in the back is all
do some differentiation. Right. I was hoping that wear away didn't wasn't what we do to the various parties engaged in this issue.
Yeah.
WEAR wear away until we get to a conclusion.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Fisher's question.
And my question was to Brian. You used the example of a police officer, and I want to know if Senator Minnis is young enough to gain anything by the segmented plan.
Well, Senator Minnis, Mr. Chair, or Senator Fisher. Unfortunately, Senator Minnis is covered by the Portland Police and Fire Retirement Plan as an employee of that body, and he's a PERS employee from the perspective of being a legislator. So,
the term limits will take care of that.
Can I ask why the term unfortunately was used?
Well, he's saying that because the benefit provided by the Portland Police Fire and Pension System is about half of what the fellow detectives I work with would get under PERS.
Ah, thank you. I assume that we couldn't possibly have gotten our arms around all of the interest that would be present in this issue. We've just really heard from very few people. But it seems clear that there's a lot of interest in working toward a solution. And I guess I'm going to assume that there will be a continuation of the work group concept where people are asked to work together. I certainly want to hear from PERS tomorrow about how their ad hoc committee functioned and was formed and what recommendations ultimately came out of that, if for no other reason than to give us some more background on this issue. I guess I'll ask the committee if they have any further questions for Mr. DeLashman.
Yeah. One question. Do you, Mr. DeLashman, do you know who represents the PERS members of the Portland Police Association?
PERS members of the Portland
Police, of the Portland Police Association?
Sworn or non-sworn?
Sworn.
Sworn would be myself.
So the members of the Portland Police Association, sworn members,
that are
who are
PERS
on PERS,
or PERS,
you represent those individuals?
Through the Oregon Council of Police Association.
Through the Oregon Council of Police Association. Okay. Can I throw one other question out there, unrelated to these guys, because I sense we're going to adjourn here. So.
Shortly.
Okay. I kind of wanted to know if anybody out there who's been doing the think tank stuff on what to do with PERS has thought of, and I'm not sure if the current law allows the government to municipalities to offer a retirement plan other than PERS or an opt-out.
They do. We've discussed that in other forums, and I think the PERS folks can speak to that issue, but the opt-out program has to be as good or better than
right.
the benefits that are currently available.
Well, and maybe that's the issue I need to discuss, because there are some programs being advanced by the American Legislative Exchange Council called defined contribution portfolio programs that have some benefits, et cetera. And the issue for me is a choice issue. If the government I work for came to me and said, we have a plan available to you if you want to be part of it, and I choose to be part of it, that allows me to have control over my investment portfolio. And if I make the choice to do that, which is substantially what this defined contribution plan does, at least in my opinion, I should be free to do that, because my retirement then is, you know, when I can retire is contingent upon how well I do in terms of the choices I make. So
it may work forever.
Yeah, probably. With my luck, that's the history of my family.
Anyway. Any further questions for Mr. West? Thank you both.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
This has been very informative, this one, and I particularly appreciate the deference with which the various groups are approaching this issue. Seems like everybody wants to come to some closure on the question. Tomorrow morning, we're going to have a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 1021, and our committee will convene Thursday, June 13th, 2002, at 10 a.m. in Hearing Room A. And at that point in time, I would like to invite the members from the Public Employees Retirement Board or staff to come and offer their perspective on the issue. We'll also make a reservation for public comment for a brief period of time in case others want to make their wishes known. We will, if a lot of folks turn out, we do have some deadlines facing us for floor sessions, so we might have to limit the duration of testimony, but we certainly do want to hear from people who want to see a solution on this issue. So let me just reiterate, tomorrow at 10 a.m. we'll reconvene for this issue. Any of the members here today want to make any comments about what you've heard today before we close the public record? Well, again, I just really appreciate the deference with which everyone has approached this issue. It's a very thorny issue, and clearly it's going to be one of great interest. With that, we are in adjournment. 10 a.m.